This is the State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. North Carolina started to reopen Friday, kicking off the first of three phases to roll back weeks of coronavirus restrictions. Officials are still recommending social distancing, but more businesses are starting to open up, and the governor's orders now allow some non-essential trips. Is the state reopening too fast? Is it too soon? Richard Watkins is paying close attention to the data and developments around the world to try to glean answers. He's an expert in microbiology and immunology. His dissertation focused on AIDS, and he has studied several other key viruses like the flu and SARS. He's also the founder and CEO of the Science Policy Action Network, a nonprofit organization that's dedicated to bridging the gap between the scientific community and the general public. Richard has a deep background in science, but he's also been involved in several other worlds all at the same time. As a kid, he competed nationally as a speed skater. He played varsity football in college, even ran for Congress. Richard Watkins, welcome back to the show. Good to have you back on the State of Things.
It's good to be here. How are you doing, Frank?
Well, I'm doing fine. How are you?
I'm doing well.
You're doing well? Okay. I'm glad to hear that. You know, now it's been a couple of days since North Carolina moved into phase one. What's your take on the decision to start and the way we're doing it?
Well, I think we're just going to take it one step at a time. We've never been in this position before, and we're having to juggle a lot of different things. So, of course, number one is saving lives. Also, we need to make sure that people are able to earn a living and provide for themselves. When you started this interview, you said, "How are you doing?" And I said, "I'm doing great." I said I'm doing great because I'm lucky, I'm fortunate. There are a lot of people who are not doing great, a lot of people who are in hospitals, a lot of people who are working in a hospital, a lot of people who are trying to figure out how are they going to put food on their tables. So this is not an easy thing for a lot of people. And so we're going to take it one step at a time. And my fingers are crossed, hoping that we can reopen everything and still save lives. But we'll just have to wait and see.
Well, what are we waiting and looking at as we see how this unfolds? What are you watching as we move through phase one?
Well, there's a lot of other places that are dealing with this situation as well. I think Wuhan is really, really important. I know there are a completely different part of the globe, but they are going to be very, very important because obviously that is where the outbreak and the pandemic started. And they have been very, very aggressive at trying to deal with the spread of the virus. And recently they have started lifting restrictions, several weeks now, and seeing what they're experiencing as far as their cases and their deaths and the burden on their medical system is going to be really, really important for guiding the rest of the world. The rest of the world is doing different things. Georgia a while ago started to ease restrictions. North Carolina, as of Friday last week, started easing restrictions. And so we're slowly wading into the water. And, of course, my hope is that this happens successfully.
Well, given your expertise, how do you put these disparate experiences together? Sweden, for instance, really mandated almost no restrictions. And so what do we take from these various lessons? People who were there first and now are through it, people who opened earlier, and those who had few restrictions from the start. How do you sum that up?
This is all very complicated. On one hand, you've got the virus. On the other hand, you have society. And societies are imagined in very different ways. Sweden is very different from the United States, which is very different from Wuhan. So a lot of these things are going to come into effect in regards of the spread of the virus. But for example, if you have a situation where you can provide for your family, then it may be more easy for you to take off. If I'm not able to provide for my family unless I go into work, then it's going to be a lot different. And so societies who have programs in place that allow workers to take off without a lot of consequences, they're going to experience the pandemic differently. So all of these things come into play. In the United States, for example, you know, the states can kind of approach the situation how they see fit. The federal government obviously can provide guidance, resources, and overarching policies on how to approach this, but a lot of power is given to states. And so the states can approach this situation differently depending on what's happening for them. But the only thing that makes that a little bit complicated is that the impact of states' decisions don't just affect that state. Obviously, people actually move between states, and so that makes things a little bit complicated. But
have we learned any more about, you know, just from what we know about the virus itself, have we learned more about that, the disease process, and the way it spreads to make more refined decisions about how we are going? For instance, face masks, are they effective? If everybody just wore a face mask, could we keep particulates from getting into the air? How much good does that do us? That's the kind of thing I'm wondering about at this point. Do we know more about the virus to make practical steps more refined?
I think where you're going, at least where I think you're going, and please correct me if I'm wrong, mm-hmm. when we reopen and we go back to business as normal, so to speak, are we going to do that with face mask on? And is that practice of wearing face mask or is that practice of personal protective equipment guided by our understanding of the virus, is that going to protect us as we go out into the world, as we go to our job? And face masks do protect you and those around you. You cough, you sneeze, you breathe, droplets, particulates, carrying viruses spread. They land on surfaces. Somebody can touch that surface and then touch their eyes, touch their nose, touch their mouth, and then the virus can enter into them. Now, if you wear a barrier, then that prevents those things to a certain degree. Now, obviously, not all barriers are created equally. Now, you have your medical grade, you know, face mask, and then you have your made-at-home face mask. Now, obviously, the mask that you purchase to use in a medical setting and a research setting, those are going to be the best ones. But any way that you can cover your mouth when you sneeze, when you do a lot of other things, that will, you know, slow the spread of virus, which is why they've told us since you were a little kid, hey, you're sneezing, you're coughing, please cover your mouth. Right. It's the same thing because the virus is contained in droplets and particulates. And we want to stop those. So we do know a lot about viruses in general. We know a lot about the corona family of viruses, which COVID-19 is a family of. And a lot of that is some of the reasons that we were able collectively to jump on this virus as far as vaccine development and so on and so forth. So we know a great deal about how viruses spread. We don't know how, you know, society will really tolerate modifications in how it operates in order to slow the spread of viruses. We really, really don't know that. And so we're seeing a lot of interesting things. And I mean, everybody is when they look out and watch the news and so on and so forth. I think we're learning a lot of different things about ourselves as we stay at home.
Well, I wonder what your biggest fears are, because we know that, and you know, until we have an effective vaccine, this thing is out there. And, you know, if people get together again, you know, there's a likelihood that we could see an increase in cases. So my question to you as an expert and somebody who knows a lot about how these viruses work, what's your biggest fear at this point?
So, of course, my biggest fear is loss of life. And when people start going back to business as normal, we'll have huge, you know, peaks in infection, but we really don't know what's going to happen. Actually, my biggest fear overall is that we don't learn lessons from COVID-19, because there's no reason to believe that a virus with increased mortality won't be the next pandemic or won't be the pandemic after that. Because there's one thing that is guaranteed, is that we will experience other pandemics. COVID-19 will not be the last. It's not the first, and it will not be the last. And so my biggest fear is obviously twofold. The first being is that society is not able to deal with the consequences that we're currently experiencing with COVID-19. You know, we see a lot of instability with, you know, protests and so on and so forth. And if that's prolonged, I don't know what impact that is going to have. We've never seen anything like this before. And again, second, I will repeat that if we have a more severe virus, I mean, this virus is very lethal, very deadly, but if we have one that is even more dangerous, that is able to spread and causes more deaths, I mean, how are we able to deal with that? And so I really do think that this can give us an opportunity to kind of step back and reexamine our society and a lot of our infrastructure so that we can be prepared for the next pandemic.
All of that, and I guess better ways to communicate the science to the public, which is something that you're very interested in. So we're going to take a break right now, come back and talk about just that when my conversation with Richard Watkins continues on the State of Things, founder and CEO of the Science Policy Action Network that aims to connect scientists to policymakers and the public. We'll continue our conversation on the State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Please stay tuned. This is the State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. My guest today, Richard Watkins, the CEO of the Science Policy Action Network, which is dedicated to connecting scientists with policymakers and the public. Richard has a doctorate in microbiology and immunology, and he's the program coordinator for the Chancellor's Science Scholars Program at UNC Chapel Hill. And that is designed to open up science for people of color and connect students to mentors. Richard's work is focused on science, but he has many other interests that have shaped his life. Sports played an important role in his childhood and young adulthood, and he's dabbled in politics as well. So, Richard, let's get to know you a little bit. Born in Texas, moved to North Carolina as a child. What brought your family here?
Yeah, so my dad went from Texas College in Tyler, Texas, to North Carolina A&T, where he was the baseball coach. And I remember... It was a very wild experience because I came to visit my grandparents over the summer, as I would from time to time, and I loved it so much. I love visiting North Carolina, and I remember I hopped in the minivan to make the road trip from Texas to North Carolina, a little town called Oak Ridge, North Carolina, and I told my grandparents, you know, I'm never coming back to Texas. And I was just saying that at the time. I was just saying that, right?
You might have been meaning it, but you couldn't do anything better. Go ahead.
I was just saying it, right? You know? But there was a phone call one night, and my grandma called me to the kitchen. She had the old rotary phone at the time. Mm. And I grabbed the phone from her, and it was my dad on the other end. He said, hey, Rick, how would you like to live in North Carolina? And I was like, what? And he's like, yeah, I just got a job. And I just started screaming. I just could not believe I was going to have the opportunity to live in North Carolina. And the rest is history. And so that's what brought me to North Carolina.
You spoke it into being. Well done.
It was awesome. It was awesome.
And as you say, he was a baseball coach at A&T, and you had a role on the team as well, right?
Yeah, that was really, really cool. I was a bat boy. I mean, I would be around my dad all the time. I mean, from baseball practice to setting up batting cages to traveling with the team. And I was a bat boy. And at that time, a lot of teams that we played against had other bat boys, usually the sons of the coaches. And you go out there after the batter has finished and you collect the bat so that the batter's box is ready for the next at bat. And you run back to the dugout and every player has their favorite bat, and you get a chance to know the players and the bats. And I mean, these college athletes to, you know, basically a 6 and 7 year old are like, you know, superheroes. And so I found a picture not too long ago of it. And I'm just this little miniature version of all these giant athletes. And it was just so incredibly amazing to be able to have that as an experience.
And you played baseball for a couple of years, but then your real passion turns out to be, at least around that age, speed skating, right?
Yes. When I mention that, whether it's at a dinner party or just out and about, people usually are just, you know, gobsmacked, like, what? Speed skating? And they chuckle. They can't believe it. And then they start talking about it. But, I mean, speed skating was incredible. You know, how I fell into it is, I told you my dad was really big into baseball, big into every sport. And he used to play softball for a radio station in Greensboro, North Carolina. And we were there one day, and there were some kids, you know, our same age there. And my sister, myself, and the two kids, we really hit it off. And we, you know, talked to our parents and letting us hang out. And one of the first things that we did was we went to the skating rink in Greensboro. Skateland USA on Stagecoach Road in Greensboro, North Carolina. I'm still there. You can check it out yourself if you feel like skating. And I went there, and it was you rented skates, the brown skates with the orange wheels, and they had different events. They had couple skate where you've been eyeing somebody the entire evening, get a chance to approach that person and say, hey, would you want to hold hands and skate with me to the slow song? And then they had this number called the speed number. So the whole night, there are people running around the floor, officials telling you to stop skating so fast. But this was the moment where you could show your stuff. You could get out there and you could skate as fast as you wanted. Now, how they did it is they broke it up, you know, girls and boys. And so the girls went out there and skated, boys went out there and skated. And then the third number of the speed skating number was when they allowed the speed team to take the floor. And they turned down the lights, and they played all like the little disco lasers and so on and so forth. And they played this song called Welcome to the Jungle. Have you ever heard of that song?
Yes. And now I can see you skating to it. Keep going.
But I wasn't skating at that time. I laid on the floor just gazing out onto the skating rink as these speed skaters just raced around the floor to that music. Mm. And I was like, I've got to do that. That's got to be me. And the rest is history, I suppose.
So there it is. This thing, it you're absolutely mesmerized by it. You've got to do it. There's a little romantic connection here. Here's a way to maybe get to meet people. But you're actually doing this competitively. How far? You went up the chain a little bit and were a strong competitor, right?
Right, yeah. Like, my first practice was that very next Saturday. I didn't know what I was doing. I didn't have any skates, stumbled and fall, but you know, I really started, you know, I was on my skates at least 5 days a week, if not more, just skating every single day. And I got a chance to join a team, join the club, and you ended up competing. The first level of competition is what they call Junior Olympics. And the next level is standard. So starting off as Junior Olympic, my first year, I went to Nationals, which was absolutely amazing. And because I had broke my leg that year at practice, and I was like in a boot, or not a boot, but a long leg cast for 3 months. Mm. Took the cast off. My leg was shriveled up and hairy and smelly. So I really had to rehab that leg. And I had to be like 10 years old when this happened. I had to rehab my knee by riding the bike because my joints had, you know, kind of fused together in my left knee.
Wow, yeah.
Recovered and was able to win states that year. And then
you won states that year because the strength, just rebuilding the strength. I mean, the first time on skates, you must have been skating in these little tight circles when one leg worked and the other one.
That's exactly what it was. But
and then you went to the champs.
Yep, I had the support of my my dad, my mom, and watching my sister just annihilating competition. In fact, the story didn't end so well. I know you're waiting for this amazing ending, but no, I got to Nationals and was disqualified. Yeah. And I'm sobbing and crying. And then the same Nationals where I got disqualified, my sister won a gold medal. And I just don't know how my parents managed those emotions with my sister winning a gold medal and then their son getting disqualified. I just don't know how they managed it. But I wasn't able to medal at Nationals until 3 years later. But my sister was absolutely amazing.
But you did ultimately medal, right?
Yes, I did. Ultimately medal. Yes, I did.
So this is it. And there's a strong pull now and you're an accomplishment in speed skating. And then you transitioned to football in high school, right?
Yes, I did. I did. Actually, I started playing football in middle school. I started playing football. That was my first time playing football. I was in eighth grade at Kaiser Middle School. That was my first time playing football. It was awesome. It was awesome. The coolest thing about football is just, you know, the social capital that comes along with it. You know, being a football player, even in middle school, was really, really cool. And then transitioning on into high school, I mean, it was really, really amazing being able to play football for Grimsley High School. That was an amazing experience.
Two very different sports, it seems to me, in terms of your mental preparation and physical preparation. I mean, how was that for you? Because one, you know, one's a team sport, one is more or less an individual sport. I mean, I wonder how you navigated that transition.
They're very different. You know, psychologically, they're very different. You know, in speed skating, you would get disqualified for, you know, trying to pass an opponent and, you know, accidentally shoving that opponent out of the way. I mean, they could be very strict on that.
Yeah.
Whereas football is probably one of the most violent sports ever created. And so in one regard, they actually discourage physical contact. And the other sport, they celebrated.
Yeah.
And so it was vastly, vastly different. But it was still fun. And now I was surrounded by people who played football. You know, you mentioned speed skating. You know, people say, what? And then they laugh. You mentioned football. That doesn't happen. Everybody has an opinion on football. Everybody loves football. And so being able to participate and compete in a sport that really everybody had feelings about and celebrated at that time was really incredible and allowed me to kind of transition into what I would say, I guess, popularity in high school. I wasn't a super popular kid, but, you know, playing football allowed you to be noticed.
Well, let's talk about college. You decided to go to Fayetteville State University for college. What drew you there?
I was able to play football in college, which was incredible. I never really thought that I was good enough to play football in college, but I got the opportunity. And I was also able to secure a academic scholarship. So at Fayetteville State, I was a chancellor scholar as well as a football player. And so that was a weird experience in two worlds. Here you are rewarded and I guess celebrated academically, and then the ability to play football with some of the most amazing athletes that I've ever been around was a reward and celebration of athleticism, and being able to live in those two worlds was quite a blessing.
You were known as the outlaw and on the football team, not in the classroom, I think.
Well, not just me. That was our nickname for wide receivers. The wide receivers were the outlaws. And, you know, I was very fortunate to be able to play wide receiver. I think wide receiver is the best position in all of football. You know, you're able to catch touchdowns, dance, you're the fastest athlete on the field. Wide receivers are amazing. So shout out to all the wide receivers listening. You all have the best athletes in the world.
And, you know, it's a position that naturally socially distances from the rest of the offensive line. So, you know, you can actually play that now, that position. The rest of the guys have to go home. They have to stay in the locker room.
I was already preparing for this.
That's right.
Way back then.
Talk about your major. What did you decide? Because you changed your majors at FSU, right?
Yeah, I got to Fayetteville State, and I was a business major. I just wasn't interested in the classes. But that all changed when I took Psych 101 with Dr. Sam Hasty. He was such an energetic professor, and the subject matter was so interesting. You know, why do people do what they do? Why do people think what they think? And that was my introduction into that world. And from that moment on, I knew that I was going to change my major. I went to my advisor a little bit after that, and I was like, I want to change my major. And that's exactly what I did.
You went to psychology, and then what about grad school? Is that what you thought you were going to do? Did you have a career mapped out for yourself? Obviously, the coursework is interesting, but did you imagine where that was going to take you and where you might go to grad school?
Well, I mean, I didn't know I was going to go to graduate school at first. You know, being at Fayetteville State, I was given a lot of, you know, opportunities to, you know, participate in leadership positions, extracurricular leadership positions from you know, PsyChi, which is a psychology honor society, to the Psychology Club, which is kind of like the support interest group for psychology majors. Being in these positions, you know, gave me access to faculty. And anytime you can hang out with faculty, people who are also passionate about research and psychology and sciences, they're able to guide you, and you're able to get a lot of information. And I was brought to a kind of a graduate school workshop, a graduate school kind of festival, so to speak, for West Virginia University when I was still at undergrad. And when I went there, I really realized that going to graduate school and becoming a doctor, becoming a researcher, and making an impact on the world was a possibility for me. And through the support and, you know, nourishment provided to me by those generous faculty, Dr. Hilton and Dr. Hasty at that time, among others, I really started zooming in.
I mean, that's interesting because they really identified you as somebody who would do well in graduate school. And as you were saying, at that point, you hadn't seriously considered it, and they kind of buttonholed you and said, I think you'd make good grad school material, and that pretty helpful
to you.
That's
exactly what happened. Yeah. That's exactly what happened, yes, absolutely. And so, yeah, my father and my mother were really supportive. My dad received his master's, and I've been out of college my entire life. So just a little shove was all that was needed for me to, you know, start taking the necessary steps to get into graduate school. But it was very hard for anybody who is trying to do something and, you know, they get denied the first time. The only thing that I can say is keep pushing through, because I was turned down from graduate school, you know, like 3 times. And so it took a lot of resilience, a lot of tears. I've almost memorized rejection letters until I was able to get my, you know, first opportunity at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill through the support of everybody that they have in place there, from Dr. Leslie Laria to Dr. Patricia Feltz, who's no longer there, and Doug Sear. Those are all really amazing people who kind of gave me an opportunity, and not to mention my very first, you know, crack at research, which was at Winston-Salem State University under the supervision of Aziz Olaru, where I studied hypertension. And that was kind of the first time I really got a chance to do research.
Well, let's talk for just a second about that and that research into hypertension at Winston-Salem State, because I think that also helped focus you not only on how interesting and thrilling research can be, but also on the need for it, particularly in communities that you were looking at.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, so as I said, I was in psychology, and I just needed research experience to get into graduate school. So I already knew that I wanted to go to graduate school, and I started learning about what it took to get into graduate school, because it is a competitive process. The smartest people from around the country are competing against each other for slots in graduate schools. And so I had to get experience with research. And so I utilized networks that my father had to really connect with a researcher who was doing hypertension and looking at it from a neurological perspective, which was close enough related to psychology that I could do it. At least I thought I could, because that stuff was hard. I mean, working with rats, I'd never handled animals before. And the amount of pressure that I was under to perform was an amazing experience. In addition to the pressure and the expectation, they gave you a lot of support. And that's when I started realizing, okay, I can do basic research and really, really make an impact on the world. Hypertension is a massive impact. But ever since a little kid, I had been interested in how this kind of microenvironment works inside your body and how bacteria and viruses are actually always at constant odds, an evolutionary arms race with your immune system that's working really, really hard to keep you healthy. And at that time, the biggest thing, it was in the face of everybody, was HIV. TLC had a verse that was about HIV and AIDS in their song Waterfalls, And so even as a little kid growing up, you knew about HIV and you knew its impact. And I felt that if I could work on that, then I could have some sort of impact. And even if I just did a little part, then that could just be just one little, you know, piece that leads to, you know, the saving of a life.
Well, we'll talk about how that I'm going
to
take a break right here and talk about how all of those thoughts led to your going to UNC Chapel Hill and focusing on immunology and virology. I'm talking about that with my guest, Richard Watkins, CEO of the Science Policy Action Network and coordinator of the Chancellor Science Scholars Program at UNC Chapel Hill. And our conversation continues after this. Please stay with us. This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stachow, talking with Richard Watkins, founder and CEO of the Science Policy Action Network, which is dedicated to bridging the gap between scientists and the general public. Also, the program coordinator for the Chancellor Science Scholars Program at UNC Chapel Hill, and that helps open up science to people of color and connect students to mentors. And we're going to talk about all that in a minute. I just want to hear a little bit more about your academic career, because you went to UNC Chapel Hill. Remember, you were a business major, then a psychology major. Then you do some research in hypertension at Winston-Salem State. And now you're going to go to UNC Chapel Hill for grad school and focus on immunology and virology. What was that transition like?
That transition was unlike anything that I've ever experienced. I mean, you are sitting shoulder to shoulder with the smartest people ever. That's just intimidating, and it's a whole nother world. I mean, one of my classmates or members of my cohort is now leading United States vaccine research efforts at the National Institutes of Health or National Institutes of Allergy and Infectious Disease, Dr. Kazmikia Corbett. Those are the type of people that you would rub shoulders with, and I felt at that time that, like, everybody was smarter than me. These people had been doing research on these particular subjects for 4 years, and they had been taking majors and classes that were very related to what they were doing now. And I had transitioned from psychology to basically basic research at the School of Medicine at UNC. And so that was a tough transition until I started realizing that this was a lot different than undergrad. You see, undergrad was about memorization and regurgitation. You know, you study, you perform on a test. Memorization and regurgitation, that's undergrad. But that's not graduate school. Graduate school was a whole different animal, a whole nother beast. In order to progress in graduate school, in order to get a PhD, I had to discover something that no one else had ever discovered before. I mean, that is the process of getting your PhD. That is a completely different exercise. But it was quite liberating.
Well, talk about it. What did you land on? And talk about that research that you did that brought you into that next frontier.
Absolutely. So how you progress through graduate school, at least in my program, is you do rotations. Those rotations gave me an opportunity to study HIV, first and foremost. I also had an opportunity to do a little bit of research in SARS, which is related to COVID-19 as part of the coronavirus family. And then I landed on HIV again. And ultimately, I decided, or I was able to do my research on exactly understanding the exact component of HIV that prompts disease progression, which means the immune system degrades to a point that it's no longer able to protect itself from things that it would normally be able to fend off quite easily, leading to the appearance of diseases that are normally not seen in healthy individuals and the development of what we call AIDS. I was able to do that research. So I worked with the virus directly, looked at viral evolution, how the virus changes over time to accomplish different things, and so on and so forth. And so that was my dissertation work. And so I worked with a team of researchers under the guidance of Dr. Victor Garcia, who was an amazing mentor, helping making me who I am today, incredible, incredible researcher, as well as a team of researchers forming my dissertation committee. So I basically worked on why HIV makes us sick.
Yeah, and it is clear that that kind of research and how that would benefit all of us when it comes to prevention, treatment, and cure, the kind of the stuff of your research. But you've also taken it the next step, which is to communicate this stuff and make sure that policymakers understand what's going on in that world and how things work, and that we in the public understand so that we can hold those policymakers accountable when they come up with a solution. So talk about the Science Policy Action Network, why you founded that.
You hit the nail on the head. I can't really say it better than that, but since I'm on your show, I'm going to try to say it better than that. You did a fantastic job, Frank. I had always, you know, in graduate school, even though I was focused on research, I took advantage of opportunities for leadership in much the same way that I did at Fayetteville State. I served on the Graduate and Professional Student Federation Executive Cabinet, legislative branch, and I also served on the honor court staff, on the attorney general staff, because I wanted the opportunity, even though I was a researcher, to work in with people in different arenas, because science doesn't exist in a vacuum. It exists in a broader context of society, and I felt that as a researcher, I was called to understand that broader context and to work to improve it. Because science interfaces with every single aspect of our life. And if we are able to nurture the network of science and all the people who interact with it, society is going to thrive. And so I wanted to be part of that effort. And that is why I created the nonprofit, the Science Policy Action Network. And we wanted to focus primarily on that network at the state level. And so that's what we started doing in the state of North Carolina. And we started in the state of North Carolina because, quite frankly, you can't spell science without NC. So where else?
There you go. But there is an I in science. Well, never mind. Let's talk about what do you think scientists can do to better communicate? I mean, obviously, we should all be working hard to make sure we understand as citizens. But what should scientists be doing to communicate better?
Yeah, scientists should do exactly what we're doing now, you know, taking advantage of opportunities to jump on a radio show and to talk with really, really cool hosts like yourself. But it doesn't have to be, you know, that fancy. I consider this fancy, Frank. This is the fanciest thing I've ever done. I'm famous now. But if you have an opportunity to talk at it at a barbershop, talk about it at church or your place of worship, at a family function, bring it up. I mean, you are a scientist, but you're also a soccer mom. You're also a member of the Homeowners Association board. You're also part of so many other things. And if you're able to bring yourself as a scientist to those spaces, that is how we work to do that. And so everywhere you can bring up a part of your science to make yourself more relatable is really, really huge. But if I can make another plug, if you are a scientist that wants to just stay in the lab and do research and not communicate your research to anyone else, but you know you should, just give me a call. I can help you out. That's why we exist.
All right, that sounds great. Just don't hire a PR firm. Call you first, and I think we'll start there. Let's talk about some of the conceptions and misconceptions that we can be vulnerable to. I mean, there's all these conspiracy theories now that are starting to percolate and actually gain ground. And I want to talk about this in a very specific way, particularly with regard to the conspiracy theories surrounding the coronavirus, because it is quite possible, quite conceivable that that people with malevolent motives can work in a lab, either in Beijing or McLean, Virginia, or in Russia, to create a harmful agent. We do that for a living here and abroad. So it's not as though that can't happen.
Right.
But what I want to talk to you about is the science. The fact is we are able, science is able to trace the source of a virus like this. As impossible as that might seem to those of us who haven't been trained, I can tell you what marketplace it came from by tracing its DNA. We have that capability, and so how much should we trust the ability? How firm is that? How good is that science when we hear, yeah. we can trace it to that place at that time.
Well, let me start with the point you made about humans being able to create a virus. We can. We can modify viruses. But let me just be honest with you. Humans, we're not the scientists that Mother Nature is. Mother Nature is already doing a good enough job at introducing viruses into people. I mean, the way that viruses evolve with humans to emerge randomly because we interact with places that we've never been, Mother Nature can do it on its own. And I just don't think we are as good at this point. We don't know enough about viruses to really make the mutations in a dependable way that could generate pathogenic viruses. We can, but we're just not that good at it. By saying that, I can also say that I have heard of no evidence whatsoever to this point to support the notion that this virus that is involved with COVID-19 started in a lab and emerged from a lab. I've heard no evidence of that. I don't know what evidence supports that. But that doesn't mean that, you know, lies or misinformation can't grow legs and spread. I mean, you know, misinformation spreads almost effectively as viruses. So,
well, I guess that speaks to the importance of making sure that scientists get out there and at least try to spread the truth the best they can. And you're involved in another network, too, and I want to make sure we have time for this, about the Chancellor's Science Scholars Program. Tell us about that and why you think that's important.
Sure, absolutely. Well, because we deal with things like this. We deal with problems that threaten our very existence, from emerging viruses that, like I said, don't have to come from a lab, just have to come from deforestation. It's simple, just one bat. Climate change and all of the impacts and manifestations that come from climate change, overpopulation, strain on natural resources, technology, how it interfaces with society, how it will compromise our values and ethics and the way we do things. These are the grand challenges that face us. And a lot of these grand challenges threaten the very existence of people, you and me. And let me back up a little bit, because a while ago you asked me, what scares you most about COVID-19 or the reopening of the government? And I said all this stuff, blah, 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 blah. But the really scary thing, honestly, is that I'll be infected, or that my daughter will be infected, or my wife will be infected, who has suffered from heart failure. I can't lose those two. They're the most important thing to me. Being that my family faces all of these things, the only thing that stands in the way of those horrible things out there in my family is talent. That's all it is.
And the Chancellor's, this program, we didn't point out yet, the Chancellor's Science Scholars Program really does have as part of its mission to encourage minorities, people of color, to get into the sciences. Am I right?
You got to have that. Yeah, you don't know who holds the idea that is going to cure cancer. We don't know. And because we don't know who has the next idea, there is no way we can create obstacles to prevent certain groups of people from entering into the scientific arena. So we have to enhance diversity, because diversity is synonymous with excellence. And that's the only way we're going to find cures and save lives.
Well, and you talked about the barriers, too. And I think the need for programs like this and the need for other programs that affirm what you just said. You talked about Kamika Corbett, who is really in the vanguard of finding out and getting to the bottom of what this coronavirus is at NIH. And she's finally gotten some attention for her efforts in unlocking some of the secrets. She was somebody who was recommended for Project SEED for gifted minorities. That allowed her to study chemistry at UNC mm-hmm. Chapel Hill, and also accepted a scholarship for minority science students. So there's a case where clearly having programs like that put a person like Kamika in a position, to help all of us, right? And who knows if she'd have been in that position without those programs.
Yeah, absolutely. And actually, this is really, really interesting. The program that she was involved with at the University of Maryland, Baltimore County, was known as the Meyerhoff Scholars Program. producing massive amounts of the top-level scientific talent in the United States. In fact, the Surgeon General, the current Surgeon General, is a product of that program. Our program, the Chancellor of Science Scholars at the University of North Carolina Chapel Hill, is modeled after that program.
Well, I can't let you go without asking you about your run for national office. Actually, you ran for Congress. Talk about that. Talk about running in the primary against David Price.
That was absolutely incredible. That was incredible. I mean, David Price is a giant. I mean, his name is David, but he's Goliath. You can't listen.
Now, Goliath lost. David Price doesn't lose.
Yeah, I know. We swapped it out. That's why I said. But this is the most interesting. I would go to places, whether it's barbershops, right? And I would tell people that I was running for Congress, and they ask questions like, "What district are you running for?" The 4th congressional district, and they'll look at you confused, and they cock their head to the left and to think, wait, isn't that David Price's seat? Yeah. No, I'm sorry, you're mistaken. No, that's your seat. He represents you, not the other way around. And they said, wow, I've never thought of it that way. And that happened over and over and over and over and over again. And so regardless of whether you like me or you hated him, being able to participate in like the first Democratic primary for the 4th congressional district in almost 30 years was exciting for people. And being able to be a part of that was incredible, but the stakes could not have been higher. You know, I got tired of seeing people suffer, people struggle, people sick, and I wanted the opportunity to try to help them. And so that's why I decided to run in that primary. But it was an incredible experience.
Richard, what a pleasure. Thanks so much to talk with you. Good to
pleasure
talk with
all
you.
Mine.
Richard Watkins, CEO of the Science Policy Action Network and coordinator for the Chancellor Science Scholars Program at UNC Chapel Hill. You can find out more at our website, stateofthings.org. Our program is produced by Anita Rao, Amanda Magnus, Grant Hullab-Mormon, Kaya Findlay, and Stacia Brown. Josie Taras is our intern. Jenny Lawson, our technical director. Al Budarski also helped engineer today's show. North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stacia.